This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
A new health care proposal is in the works. We talk about that now on The Patriot Preacher. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to The Patriot Preacher, covering the news from a Christian perspective. Welcome to the program. I'm Caleb Colquitt, and I have Joe Marcus here with me on this Friday morning trying to get you through the last part of the week. Hang on, just a few more hours till the weekend.
Tickling the ivories.
Right.
I've been practicing every day.
We've got a lot to get to on this Friday. We actually have a full show for a Friday, but we've got everything lined up. We think it's going to be a great show. Now, this was one proposal that I wanted to talk about because, of course, you have to know the basis and get a little bit of the background of what's been going on. Because with everything that happened with James Comey, we're actually going to start with the non-Comey news, as CNN would call it. For those of you who are following me on Facebook and Twitter, they have a whole section on CNN.com just titled The Non-Comey News. So they have so much Comey news, they have to differentiate the two. Now, with this particular topic where we're talking about health care, the new proposals, that kind of thing, it's interesting because this is what the news cycle was before James Comey was fired. And that's all people were talking about. And now, of course, Jim Comey is what everyone's talking about. So I thought it was important to not take our eye off the ball here and still look at what Congress is doing. Of course, we've talked about James Comey. In fact, we're going to talk about it here in a second when we're done talking about health care. But I did want to keep this in front of your eyes because I think that it is that important. And I don't want us to get so bogged down in the soap opera that is what's going on in the White House right now that we lose sight of real policy changes that will affect our lives and affect them personally. So the new health care bill, which passed the House and moved on to the Senate, was expected to be watered down. And it looks like that is what's going to happen. So it was already not exactly super conservative, and it may get even less conservative as time goes on. It's honestly hard to imagine it getting any more watered down, considering that it leaves about 85% to 90% of Obamacare intact. Certainly at least 80% of it, probably about 85% to 90%. And if it gets any more watered down, then it's going to be not much different than the original proposal that you'll remember came out just a little bit ago, because part of it is they're making pre-existing conditions such a sticking point, and they're talking about some of the things that Obamacare did that, even though it's a bad idea, people still like and is still fairly popular. So the first one, the first failed proposal, that was about 98% Obamacare. It looks like this one, if senators water it down, it could get that high, and we would have essentially the same proposal as the first one, which failed the House in the first place. I don't know that. That's speculation, but it looks like that's the direction that it may be going. However, and this does give me hope, even though I think that this makes way too much sense to actually pass, Ted Cruz has come out with a proposal for a bill. He's actually proposing a new bill entirely, just kind of ignoring the one that came through the House and is on the Senate floor being debated right now. He's put forth a new proposal, and what this would include is it is a full repeal of Obamacare. So every letter of Obamacare is completely gotten rid of. It goes back to the way it was back in 2009 before this bill even passed. And then, because he doesn't just leave it at that, he also goes forward and tries to do some things to manage costs in the healthcare system, real healthcare reform from a free market standpoint. So what all would this do exactly? Well, it's important to understand the logistics of it first. It's part of a single budget resolution, and the beauty of that is it would only need 51 votes to pass because it's a budget resolution. So essentially what they would be doing is they would be getting rid of Obamacare by defunding it. And if you think that this is impossible or this has never been done, keep in mind that the border wall on the American-Mexican border was approved back in the 80s. So Congress can absolutely kill legislation by just refusing to fund it. And so this would essentially be exactly the same thing. And because it is done that way, it doesn't require the 60 supermajority. It only requires 51 votes. So theoretically, because the Democrats seem dead set against voting for anything with Trump's name on it, even if they would happen to like it. In this particular situation, we wouldn't need a single Democrat vote whatsoever to get this bill through. So this is very plausible. It's very practical. It would use the power of the purse, which, by the way, is a completely legitimate power of Congress. It's alluded to by our founders in the Federalist Papers, by James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. It's talked about, and that's part of the structure that was put into our system, that Congress has the ability to decide what where money gets spent, where money doesn't get spent. And so they can essentially work the system that way to use their power of Congress to defund programs that are bad. So in this new budget resolution, it would use the power of the purse to undo the ACA or Obamacare, whatever you want to call it. Basically, it's a realization of what Ted Cruz was filibustering for in 2013. You remember how everybody was blaming Ted Cruz for the government shutdown because he did the filibuster during the budget, which, by the way, one person can't shut the government down. That's not how it works. He had to have the backing of other senators to do that. So people can point to Ted Cruz and say he's the reason, but it was the Senate Republicans. It was all they were on board with it. In fact, the reason his filibuster ended was because the Senate Republicans essentially just gave up because of some pork barrel spending, but I won't go into the history lesson right now. So this is a realization of what he has been trying to do since 2013 by defunding Obamacare and getting rid of it that way. Now, there is actually another path to do this. You could do a full repeal through the 60-vote process, but the only way to do that that Ted Cruz is suggesting is a possibility. He's not saying for sure that this ought to be done. He's just throwing it out there. There is another path, and that path is using Mike Pence. Mike Pence, of course, being the vice president, he has the final say on the rules in Senate. He doesn't control the Senate, obviously, but he does have the final say over the parliamentarian on how the rules go. And so Mike Pence could theoretically just say, well, we realize that typically you would need 60 votes to stop debate, but we're just going to go ahead and stop debate right now and go straight to a vote. Mike Pence can do that. He has the ability to do that. Honestly, that path makes me a little uneasy because it sets a slightly dangerous precedent. I don't want, because you have to always consider when one of these maneuvers is going to be issued. You always have to consider, and I think it's important to keep in the forefront of your mind, how would you react if it were the opposite side? So let's say we're back just a year ago, and obviously we wouldn't have had a Democrat majority then, but let's say we had a Democrat House, a Democrat Senate, and Barack Obama and Joe Biden in the White House. Joe Biden could have used exactly the same power to override it and get massive legislation through without a single Republican vote. Now, in the case of Obamacare, they didn't even need a Republican vote. That's how much of a majority they had. But the point is, I'm worried about that, and I'm worried about ignoring the Senate rules using the vice president because, I don't know, that to me sets an uncomfortable precedent. I'm not saying that it shouldn't even be considered. I'm just saying it makes me uneasy, and we have to be really careful about doing that if that's the path we want to take, because it's nice when you're in power to be able to do things like that, but you have to keep in mind you ain't going to be in power forever. In fact, when it comes to the executive orders, I think the Democrats are learning that lesson the hard way, remembering that they were all gung-ho about every executive order Obama signed, and all of a sudden, now that Trump's in office, they decide they don't really like executive orders anymore. So I'm just saying it's important for us to remember that we have to play the long game. And so when it comes to this, we may want to consider the repercussions of that in the future. All right, so we're going to get into what this bill would actually do. We looked at how it got passed. Now we're going to see what's actually in it. We're going to do that analysis when we come back. 860-1440. Sweet potato pie, and I shut my mouth.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The great pillars of all government and of social life: virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone that renders us invincible. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. Before we move on, I did want to tell you about this. We have a contest going on. And in celebration of Mother's Day, we're giving you the chance to win $4,000 for Mom by telling us what makes her great and what you would do for her if you won. You know, whether it's a trip to the spa or a big shopping spree or 1,000 bouquets of roses, cleaning services for your, it doesn't really matter. You can use the money for whatever you want, but you have to enter at newsradio1440.com. Enter today because the contest is winding down. We're going to be picking a winner soon. All you have to do is tell us what makes your mom great. Enter that contest, and hey, even if you don't win, you have something that you've already written about your mom and why you think she's great. You can give that to her for Mother's Day, even if you don't win. Now, get her something else, and I've actually, because I don't qualify for this contest, I'm a Cumulus employee, I've already bought something for my mom for Mother's Day. So, guys, get on it. It's coming up. Oh, or ladies, get on it, too, because I know you have moms as well. So, I don't know. I just, for whatever reason, it felt like saying that.
But I know something felt weird there.
Well, here's what it was, and I'll go ahead and explain my mental track here, and I think you'll understand. Because it's Thursday, Mother's Day is Sunday, the ladies probably already have something. It's the guys that I'm worried about don't have a present yet.
I'm more worried now. It's not Thursday, is it? Isn't it Friday?
Oh, it is Friday.
Yeah.
Well, see, a woman would know that.
It's funny, I put this little, trying to be humorous on my Facebook page, this little Friday 13th meme. In other words, and then I said, oh.
Today's the 12th.
Yeah, I said, it's the 12th. I know, I said, 13th isn't until tomorrow.
Yeah, a very good friend of mine's birthday is today. That's why I know what the date is. I just don't know what the day of the week it is. But anyway, getting back into what we were talking about with everything that was going on with Ted Cruz and his proposal, I'm not sure if this would get through in its entirety, but it starts a negotiation from a place of power, which is something we haven't been doing on healthcare. What we've been doing is we've going super moderate and then going further moderate and getting it watered down then. This would start us from a better position because if you know anything about negotiation, if you've haggled a price for something, you know you don't start about where you want to be, which I don't know why anyone would want to be in the positions that the previous healthcare proposals have been. But my point is, you never start close to where you want to be. You start ridiculously high or ridiculously low and then work your way to the middle. And that would be certainly not ideal, but I understand that's the way things work in this country. So, you know, maybe we could make some concessions on down the road, but why don't we start with a repeal? Because that's something that every Republican was in favor of, at least said they were, to get elected. And also that's one of the things that it was a big issue that they ran on. So why don't we start there and then move in one direction or the other? Start where we want to be and then try to figure that out. That's what this bill would do. And another thing, too, it removes the need for a three-step plan. This is important because they've said, well, don't worry that the original plans aren't very good, because what this is going to do is we're going to do it in three phases. And so the first one's going to be not very effective at all, and then we're going to gradually move three phases down to where Obamacare is, for all intents and purposes, repealed. First of all, I don't know why you wouldn't just go for it right off the bat. And second, especially considering the wishy-washy way the Republicans have been trying to get even the first phase, which is supposed to be the easiest one to get passed. Secondly, if that's the case, why don't we just do something like this that removes the need for a three-step plan? Because keep in mind, we only have 18 months left. We really only have 18 months left because, yes, Donald Trump is going to be president in 18 months, barring something crazy happening. But at the same time, we're probably going to have a turnover. If history is any teacher, we're probably going to lose quite a few seats to the Democrats. So we really only have about 18 months to get all this done. So let's go ahead, get it done right now, get it done before it's close to election season and some of the squishier Republicans are afraid that someone's going to complain and they'll wind up losing their jobs through their elections. Let's go ahead and get this done now. Start with big ideas and work our ways back instead of starting with small ideas. So this is a big, bold plan, one that I approve of. So what exactly does his plan do? Well, since it starts out removing every letter of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, it would eliminate the individual mandate, it eliminates pre-existing conditions, and it would eliminate federal regulations on what has to be covered. So the idea that I, as a 27-year-old man, have to have full maternity coverage in my insurance plan. That's gone. And I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb here and say the odds of me getting pregnant are pretty low for a couple of reasons. But I don't need that. There are a lot of people that have plans right now, even some women. I mean, if you're past a certain age, you don't really need maternity care anymore, and they're having to pay for it as well. And so this eliminates a lot of those stupid federal regulations that are saying that you need all this coverage that doesn't apply to you, and you're paying for coverage for not only yourself but for other people in the risk pool, to where you're paying for things that it is impossible for you to use, essentially. So it gets rid of a lot of those things. It takes us back to where we were before Obamacare, but then adds things to it to where we do real reform, because nobody denies that the healthcare system had some pretty deep-seated problems before Obamacare came along. I would argue, and I think most people that can just look at the numbers would say, true, but Obamacare made it worse, and that's the case. But at the same time, that doesn't remove the need to have some kind of reform to the healthcare system afterward. It opens up purchasing across state lines, which is something Republicans have been talking about for a really long time. It scales back malpractice reform. So what it would do is it makes things more affordable by reforming malpractice insurance. And it also has a provision for health savings accounts. So instead of government paying for things, you would pay into a health savings account in case something happens. It's not mandated, it's optional, but you have the ability to open up a health savings account, and this expands that ability. And another thing that I love is it takes a page from Rand Paul's plan and expands the association healthcare plans. Now, what this means is virtually anybody can buy a policy collectively. So if you're a member of a country club, if you're a member of AARP, if you're a member of the NRA, if you belong to a church, if you're a member of your local Tea Party, you can buy health insurance through that group. And what that does is it goes really far to unhitch your work from your health insurance, which is very important. You have bipartisan agreement on that. Even Democrats say that we need to do that. And so this is a really good plan. It opens up free market solutions. And I wanted to say this just as a closing thought. Just keep in mind, the man that came up with this plan, he could have been your president. I'm not trying to wag my finger in anybody's face or say I told you so or anything like that. All I'm saying is consider that. Just let it ruminate in your head for a little bit. Think about that. This guy could have been president. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in, ask a question. Keep in mind that just like every Friday, it is First Amendment Friday, which means you can call in, ask anything. You know, if you just want to ask the Patriot Preacher something, if you want to get into a subject that I haven't covered yet, this is the day to do it.
Yep, just don't mistake it for just, we're not talking just about the First Amendment. It's anything. Anything goes.
Anything goes.
I'm trying to think of a question that I could stump you with. I'm trying to think of something that I really, really want to ask.
Well,
I'll let you know.
Well, get back to us on that.
I'm not going to try to embarrass you or anything.
Well, of course, but...
But it's Friday. We'll have a little fun.
Why not?
Now he's wondering.
See, now I'm thinking what you could be coming up with. But anyway, so I did want to talk about this, though, because this was really big news. Lester Holt with NBC News last night had a big interview, probably the biggest interview of his career, with Donald Trump, because through, I don't want to say no fault of his own, because it's not like Lester Holt did anything wrong, but just by sheer circumstance, this might be the most important interview of his career, just because it happened to be scheduled and then Donald Trump fired James Comey. Now, this interview was not in response to that. They had this interview scheduled for a while before they even knew that Comey was on his way out, that Donald Trump was going to fire him. But it just so happened that it comes up a couple days afterward. And so he was really fortunate for Lester Holt. Good for him. But this particular interview, the big reveal and the big takeaway, there was a lot of good information in it, but the big reveal came with Trump announcing to the world in no uncertain terms explicitly, I wanted Comey out. Because Lester Holt was asking him about this. He was asking about the recommendation of Rob Rosenstein, the new deputy attorney general. And immediately what came out was, well, yes, that recommendation happened, but I was going to fire him anyway. Which, if that's the case, it's probably better that Donald Trump revealed that, but politically it's a bad move. Because if Donald Trump was gunning for James Comey, and now the world knows because there's live TV of Donald Trump saying, yes, I was going to get rid of him, recommendation or no recommendation, then it opens up the door to scrutiny. Now, if that's the case, and I assume that it is because there's no motivation to lie about it. In fact, there would be motivation to lie about it. But Donald Trump came out and said it, so I appreciate his honesty. I appreciate him coming forward and saying that and being honest about it. But at the same time, politically, ooh, this is not going to be good. Because now that they know that he was gunning for Comey, that suspicion that they've had all along about him going after him because of the Russian collusion, that is now in the wind, and there's some legs to that narrative. I'm not saying that that's the case. I'm not saying that's what I believe. I'm just saying that now that that is out there, that's going to be the narrative the media is pushing. Now, this was interesting, too, because if you couple that big reveal with Lester Holt last night with multiple Washington Post sources, they're saying now 30 sources that they have that have confirmed this within the White House, which is a stupid amount of sources. It's amazing that they have 30 people in the White House. And I think that speaks volumes, which we'll talk about in a second, about the Trump White House and what's going on there. So multiple sources from the Washington Post confirm that Donald Trump did not like James Comey, and that's the reason that he wanted him out. Now, there can be professional reasons, there can be personal reasons, but there's really very little debate, especially considering the president essentially said as much last night that that was the reason he wanted him out, that Trump didn't like Comey and didn't want him as the director of the FBI anymore. Now, a lot of people are suspecting that that's the reason that he did not handle the firing right, because he wasn't fired in a traditional way. The right way to do that would have been call James Comey, say, upon your return to Washington, the president would like to meet with you, or have somebody go down there, and nobody in the media, nobody even in the White House finds out about this until James Comey has his dismissal letter in his hand. That's the right way to handle it. And I talked about this yesterday. Apparently, not only did he find out that he was being fired from the news, the report now is, and several people have come out with this, that he not only found out that way, but it was while he was speaking. He's on stage speaking to FBI recruits, and all of a sudden looks on the TV, the news feed in the back window, and sees that he's been fired. That's an incredibly difficult thing to deal with, especially when you're in front of the crowd. I mean, I can't imagine being on this show and finding out that I was fired in the middle of the show during a segment, and I have to figure out a way to piece this thing together and keep going. So with Director Comey, that's harsh. I can't even imagine what that would be like. But when Trump gets it in his head that somebody doesn't like him, he has a tendency to try to embarrass them. We saw this several times in the primary with different people that were opposing him. It's not enough for Donald Trump to be ahead in the polls or to win against the other guy. He wants to actually embarrass them, make them look foolish. And we know this from several quotes by Donald Trump himself. In fact, we remember there was a clip not really all that long ago. He's speaking in Australia to something dealing with the Miss Universe pageant. And he says, and I'm going to be a little bit crass here, but I'm just quoting the president. He said, when someone screws you, you screw them back 10 times harder. And so with that in mind, knowing that personality trait of the president's, it's not that hard to imagine. Now, I don't know that he knew James Comey was actually on stage. What I'm saying is because Donald Trump knew that James Comey was, or because he believed that James Comey was not in his corner, that he was not loyal to him, that the president didn't personally like Director Comey, that he really didn't care how he handled his firing. I tend to believe, and maybe it's just because this is what I want to believe, but I tend to believe it was more carelessness than it was intentionally trying to. I don't think he could have possibly timed the news feed to air at exactly the moment that he's on stage speaking. So I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is the reason he didn't really care whether Comey got embarrassed or not, or that Comey found out the way that he did, is because he had it in his head that Comey did not like him, and I'm about to explain why. According to reports from these multiple 30 sources, like I said, within the Washington Post that they cited that are inside the White House, according to the reports, there were three main reasons that Trump disliked Comey. First of all, he did not like that Comey was not backing him up on the wiretapping. This is something that's been widely reported. Trump specifically asked the FBI to back him up on the claims of wiretapping. We remember when this happened. He tweeted that he had been wiretapped by the Obama administration, and he asked the FBI to essentially confirm that, and they said, well, we can't. There's not really any evidence for that. And so he felt kind of slighted by that, that the FBI, and this is something that the president really needs to learn. The government is not a business. He's the president, but he's not the CEO of the country. And so he can't just tell a subordinate to do something and they do it. That's not how government works. There are laws in place. There are different roles for different people. Even someone that actually does work for him, like Director Comey, can't just say whatever Donald Trump tells them to. And so I think that that was one thing that's been kind of a difficult situation for the president to adjust to. Secondly, he didn't like James Comey for not going after the leaks. Now, this one I think is a completely legitimate criticism, because it is the FBI's role to check out any leaks that are going on in any secure format, whether it's Congress, anything that has to do with the federal government where there's a leak going on, that information is getting out, that's something that the FBI should be investigating. And apparently, James Comey was less than enthusiastic and had not been doing very much to go after these leaks. I don't know if it was because he had too much on his table or whatever the reason may be. Donald Trump was apparently not happy with him for not going after the leaks. And to be honest, that's a criticism I understand. That's a criticism that if the president is frustrated with he's not going after the leaks, which the fact that we have 30 White House sources that are going to the Washington Post is indicative of the level of leaks that's going on within the Oval Office and around the president. So I understand Trump being upset about that and not figuring out where the leaks are. Also not figuring out where the leak happened that unmasked, for example, Michael Flynn, because they still haven't figured out who leaked that. People suspect it's Susan Rice. I still think that it's Susan Rice. That's where the evidence seems to be leading. And the only thing that we have that suggests it's not Susan Rice is Susan Rice saying that she didn't leak it, which is interesting considering the only thing that she's known for is lying. I mean, that's really what made her famous, is lying about Benghazi. So we already have a credibility problem there. But that being said, and based on what we know, that's a completely legitimate criticism. And there was one other thing that the president apparently did not like about James Comey, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment.
Near the station, black roof country, no gold pavement.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Christian religion is, above all the religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times, the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. John Adams.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. Now, we were talking about James Comey and the rift that had formed between him and the president, because we did find out last night from Lester Holt and President Trump's own words that he and Comey, he's the one that decided that Comey was going to go, that he would have fired him regardless of any recommendations that came from the deputy attorney general, and that it appears, according to sources within the White House, that President Trump did not much care for James Comey. And we just talked about part of the reason for that. First of all, he didn't like Comey for backing him on the wiretapping claims. Comey didn't want to confirm that because he didn't have any evidence for it. Then Donald Trump had a problem with Comey for not going after the leaks, which, again, understand the president being frustrated about that. it's got to be a pain in the, you know, in your rear when it seems like every single thing you do winds up on the front page of the newspapers the next day because so many people in the White House are willing to leak to the media. And especially when the media is not exactly friendly to you, I understand him being frustrated about that. Now, the third one, and apparently, according to the sources that the Washington Post is citing, he didn't like Comey for saying that he was nauseous that he may have affected the election. Now, this in particular apparently was the straw that broke the camel's back. That this was the last straw for Comey. Trump already had problems with Comey, didn't like the job that he was doing, and now that he said that... Now, what was James Comey actually saying? He was saying that because he doesn't like the idea that an FBI investigation or actions from the FBI could affect an election, regardless of who was in it or what the results were, it bothered him to think that he as a law enforcement officer might be affecting an election, which is the right response to have. That's the reason that, as much as humanly possible, we try to keep law enforcement separate and apart from the political realm, because you don't want people making decisions on who to enforce the law on based upon politics. But apparently, according to people inside the White House, Donald Trump took this as a personal slight. The way Donald Trump heard it was, it made me nauseous to think that the actions that I took helped Donald Trump win. In other words, I didn't want Donald Trump to win, and doing these things bothered me because I thought maybe Trump won because of me. That's not how James Comey heard it, or that's not how James Comey meant it, but it's how Donald Trump heard it. And so apparently that was a big contributing factor to Donald Trump not liking James Comey, and that was just the last straw, and he was tired of it, and that's the reason. Now, if that's the case, the timing actually does make a lot of sense. It doesn't mean that there's anything nefarious going on, which is what the Democrats are all pushing, and maybe there is, maybe there isn't. We'll look into it. But at the same time, if that happens to be the case, then that does make the timing of Comey's firing make a lot more sense. And though I know there's going to be some Trump people that are not real happy with me for saying this, frankly, that fits with what we know about the president and his personality. Whether you love him or hate him, he has a problem with his temper, and he is vindictive. He does like to embarrass people that he feels like are trying to embarrass him. And even though I don't think that Comey had it out for Trump, I mean, there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest the opposite. I think Trump felt that way, and because he felt that way, he thought that it justified him, because Trump is very big on loyalty. We've seen this throughout the primary, the way he ran his campaign. I mean, for goodness sake, you had to sign a pledge to be a part of the man's campaign that you would not say anything bad about him even after you left that position within his campaign. And so he's very big on loyalty, and he felt like the FBI director was disloyal to him. But what he doesn't understand, and again, this is the difference in Donald Trump the CEO and Donald Trump the president, when you're the CEO, you're allowed to demand loyalty from your subordinates. When you're the president, you're not. Because the FBI director, yes, he does work directly under the president and answers to the president, but he really works for the American people. And his first loyalty is to uphold the Constitution, not do what the president says.
One of the things that I have always feared about Trump, I'm kind of like you. In fact, I agree 100% that he's an egotist, that he's vengeful, that he'll try to get back at people. And one of the things that has always worried me is that he would do this on the world stage. In other words, getting a you-know-what match with Putin and, you know, or really any other world leader who disrespects him and then throws all caution to the wind, and who knows what's going to... I've always thought that.
Well, I mean, it's a legitimate concern. I'd like to think that the president has people around him that are smart enough that are saying, you know, Mr. President, we can't just jump into this. And I have to admit, so far, the missile strike in Syria, which I was very critical of, we haven't really seen any negative effects of that. If anything, we've seen a positive outcry.
Well, knock on wood.
With that. Yeah, I mean, hopefully that's the case, but even the people that were critical of that seem to have straightened up and flown right and say, hey, this president might actually do that. So in that particular case, you know, it seems like that attitude might have actually helped Trump, but at the same time, it looks like it's hurting him here. And I want to say this, too. I genuinely feel bad for Donald Trump. And I have some pity on him, and this is why. This guy has got to feel so lonely in the White House because he can't trust his own staff, and he feels like everybody's against him. Now, whether they are or not, I think there's quite a few people that are, don't get me wrong. But whether that's true or not, he's got to feel like, because he can't do anything without his own staff leaking stuff to the media on him, and he feels like the media despises him, which, I mean, they do. There's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that. And sources say he expected the firing of Comey. He expected Democrats to cheer that on. He expected when he fired Comey that all the Democrats would come out and say, yeah, we may not like Trump, but he did this right. And then, of course, the exact opposite happened, which I don't blame Donald Trump for believing that, because even though he should have realized by now that the Democrats are going to hate everything he does, regardless of whether they want it or not, keep in mind, about last week, the Democrats were running the Fire Comey hashtag campaign. So it was not unreasonable for him to believe that the Democrats were going to give him a pat on the back for this. And sources inside the White House say that that's how he thought it was going to be perceived. Obviously, it was not.
Well, a personality game, you know, who really likes who.
And that's part of the problem, that we have turned it into a little bit of a reality show. But the point is, and I wanted to say this, I hate that this has turned into a soap opera, even though I do legitimately feel bad for Trump on some issues, and I don't think that James Comey was the greatest guy in the world either. I think that he was doing the best that he could in a bad situation, but James Comey made some missteps along the way, first and foremost not recommending charges against Hillary Clinton, but that's neither here nor there. What this is a massive distraction. This whole thing is a massive distraction, because here's the thing. Somebody leaked unmasked names to the media. It's probably Susan Rice. We talked about this in the last one. The media refuses to address that. They're using this as cover so they don't have to talk about that. And then on top of that, Loretta Lynch, the former attorney general, requested the unmasking. We know that. And she requested that masking knowing that they could be leaked. And I believe that she did it specifically because she knew that they could be leaked and probably would be at some point. So looking at all that, I understand some of this, and it's all just a distraction to keep us away from that. Hour 2 coming next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
It's Friday, which means we have another Top 10 on the Patriot Preacher. Everybody, welcome back. Hour 2 of the Patriot Preacher is on now. It's Friday, so we have a top 10, and the Nerd Herd is back with me. So say hello to Andrew, AJ, and Chris. Say hi, guys.
Moo.
Hi.
Glad to have y'all back with us. It's Friday. We tried to take it a little bit easier on the last day of the week to get you pumped up for the weekend. We're going to go ahead with our top 10, and we've been talking a lot about healthcare, especially in the first hour, and some of the failures of the Republicans on that part. So I thought that it would be appropriate that this week's top 10 is the top 10 things more dependable than a Republican Congress. All right. Here we go. Number 10, a public school history textbook.
Unfortunately.
Number 9, and this one I know Chris is going to love because it's a science joke, Schrodinger's cat.
Poor thing. It's not its fault.
It doesn't know whether it exists or not. Number 8, Common Core Math.
That's the worst.
I like that one too.
Number 7, a Brian Williams autobiography.
Hey, I like Brian Williams.
Of course you do. Number 6, a T-Mobile phone signal.
Yeah.
Ouch.
It's in the South.
Number 5, the Titanic.
Oh.
Too soon.
Oh.
Too soon. Oh. It's like 80 years ago.
Too soon. Oh. It's always too soon.
Number 4, the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
Still in business?
Oh yeah, they still print. Number 3, a Hillary Clinton campaign promise. Nobody's getting anything out of those.
Nope.
Number 2, a job at Fox News. Sorry, Bill. And the number 1 top 10 thing more dependable than a Republican Congress. Dead air.
DNC Internet Security.
Oh. Too soon.
That's our top 10 for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. We're actually about to go to a break, and we'll have the Nerd Herd come back, and we're going to talk to them a little bit about something we got going on. But I do want to mention before we move on, our good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Now, these guys have been in business right here in the Montgomery area for 50 years. Incredibly dependable. They know what they're doing. They're going to be able to fix your car. Anything that's wrong with it, they'll be able to tell you what it is. They put you in the driver's seat. They let you know exactly what's wrong with your car, ask for your permission, ask what you want to do, and then they are able to do it and do it at a great price. So go by and see them today on the Troy Highway. That's Jim Woodham, Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center, right here in Montgomery. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Welcome back to the Patriot Preacher here on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. We have the Nerd Herd here for one more segment. Chris, AJ, and Andrew. So glad to have you with us, guys. Appreciate you joining us. Since all of us are millennials, and for those of you who don't know, millennials are, there's different definitions, but it's someone that was roughly born around the 80s and then spent most of their teenage years right around the turn of the century. So that includes us, and I saw this really interesting study on AL.com where they were looking at some census data that showed 35% of all millennials in Alabama live at home, which means Alabama is the 15th highest state in the nation when you're talking about the rate of millennials that are still living in their parents' house. And so I wanted to ask you guys this question, because we're all millennials here. Why do you think so many of these millennials are living at home in the South, especially when typically we think of the South as a place that teaches personal responsibility and independence?
Probably because it's cheaper.
Well, yeah, maybe so. We all either live or have lived in Alabama for the majority of our lives. So do you think there's anything in particular about this that kind of leads us to that?
I don't think it's necessarily, like you were kind of saying, you know, the culture of the South and everything. I don't know if it's really that more so than just the job market and how things are changing. I think the culture plays a role in that a lot more people are going to college these days than they used to. But the problem is a lot of people are going to college and not getting marketable degrees. And so they get out of college and they don't have anything to pay the bills. And so then, I mean, where else are you going to go? One point that was brought up in the last presidential election that I thought was a really good point was investing in more trade school training for people, because not everyone needs to go to college to get their ability to go out and get a job.
Right. And that's one thing I think a lot of people really underestimate. There's some really good paying jobs that you do not need a degree for. There's a lot in construction, jobs in the energy market, for example, that they're not necessarily low skilled jobs, but they're certainly jobs that you don't need a 4-year college degree for.
Yeah, I can attest to that. I started out in college. I went to Auburn for a little while and ended up not graduating. And what I'm making now, I don't have a degree for, and I'm making more than a lot of people with degrees.
Yeah, actually, just, you're making more than me, and I'll leave it at that.
You know, certifications, that's the way to go for a lot of stuff like this.
Yeah, and AJ, you just recently got a new certification, didn't you?
I did. I got my Security Plus, and now I'm working on my Network Plus, and that'll be like the trifecta for your groundwork. Certifications.
Right. For those of you who don't know, AJ's an IT guy, and just in case you didn't catch his introduction last week, but he works with computers, and that's not a low-skilled job by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not one that you need a college degree for either.
And we all think we're underpaid for what we do, but if you... certifications really are, they really do help. They cost a little bit of money up front, but they pay dividends in the end. And that's another thing is, like, trades and those kind of like blue collar jobs are really undervalued in today's market. Everybody thinks, oh, you need a college degree for this and you need it for that, when you don't.
I kind of agree. You guys know I sunk like 6 years into music education, taking all the college hours that I needed. Turns out being a hotel manager, you're going to make more than most of those teachers are. Not saying that teachers should get paid less or anything. I think they should definitely get paid more, but you definitely don't have to have a college degree anymore to stay in the fight for jobs.
I was actually going to ask something about that. Do you think higher poverty rates or less variety in the jobs market might be part of the reason that this seems to be a bigger problem in the South? Because typically in the South, we do have job markets for sure, but not quite as much variation in them. And we also have higher poverty rates. So I think that might be a deciding factor.
The job market is changing, but it's changing at a rate that is getting faster as time goes on. So the job market change, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe the job market has a radical shift over the course of 5 years. But now the job market has a radical shift over the course of, say, a year and a half. A lot of it's technology driven. And so if you're not able to keep up with it as a business or as an employee or as a prospective employee, then you're going to get behind. And I know, for example, there are hot spots in the country for that type of market that's getting a lot of attention that aren't necessarily in our region.
I think that that's leading to the fact that we're seeing more millennials in the South and in our own home state that is a contributing factor to that for sure. Now, a decade ago, this rate was only 26. So we're looking at that. It's not exactly doubled itself over, but it's increased by a rate of 9%, which is a pretty big boost in a short amount of time. So I think the biggest difference, and I wanted to get y'all's reaction to this since I'm the only single man in this group. I think a really big difference is marriage. Because back in the day, you had people getting married younger. And of course, when you're married, you really don't want to be living with your parents. And it also can, you have to be sort of financially stable to get into a marriage, or at least you should be. That's part of the recipe for a successful marriage. So I think a big difference actually is people getting married a lot older than they used to. And that's playing a big role in where they're deciding to live.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think it's a good point.
I think, though, and I think this might be more of a chicken or an egg scenario. Could be this vicious cycle to where you're staying at home because it's economically feasible, but it's harder to date someone while you're living at home, and so you're not dating, which means it's hard to find prospects to get married, and so it just kind of spirals downward, as it were. And so do you think that that's part of the thing, or do you think that's part of the cause and effect here, or do you think that they're just kind of independent of one another?
I would say it's related in some sense. I know a lot of people, like you said, it does make more economic sense for some people to live with their parents, even just temporarily. You know, I did that after I got back from Auburn and decided, you know, a degree wasn't my path that I should take. So I lived with my parents for about 5 or 6 months, then found a job elsewhere and got out.
Yeah, a lot of millennials are doing that. They're living at home at least for a little while, and hopefully, and I think the end goal for most millennials is to get out of the house eventually. But they move back home just for a little bit until they find a good place to live, then go there. And part of that may be contributed to from a lack of a job market. I saw another interesting study about millennials. Now, this isn't specific to Alabama. This was nationwide. But there was a survey done by the Fund for American Studies. And it said that 92% of millennials support free speech and 93% of them support religious freedom. So issues regarding our First Amendment. But then as the survey went on, they said that 54% of millennials think that we need more government involvement in our lives to protect those freedoms. The logical next step in that is, isn't that doing exactly the opposite of what you would want? More government involvement tends to lead to less free speech and less religious freedom. So I wondered what y'all thought about that, and maybe why these millennials seem a little bit confused on what religious liberty and free speech means.
They're confused as to what it means because they think free speech means their free speech, but not yours. You know, rules for thee, but not for me.
I don't think the article really specified as to how they measured it. I would be wondering if you had the same definition of free speech, for example, that you were giving to some of these survey takers, whether their interpretation of free speech is necessarily what you would interpret it as, kind of like AJ mentioned.
Well, I think that's exactly the problem. Just looking at it and seeing their reaction to the questions, I think that they are in favor of quote-unquote free speech, but they really don't understand what that means. And so when they look at it, they get a little bit confused because free speech is something they've been taught their entire lives is a good thing. But when given a practical question about it, they really aren't in favor of it. We've seen this in college campuses. I can't remember exactly who was doing this. It was maybe Jesse Waters or another one of the political commentators. They went on to an Ivy League campus and took surveys of about 100 people
And they got a really high number of people sign a petition for government controls and censorship of certain speech that they didn't like. For example, racial slurs, that kind of thing. And it was something like 70 or 80% were saying the government ought to be censoring people's speech. And so I do think that there is a romanticism about the idea of free speech with millennials, but when it comes right down to it, they don't understand what that really means.
It starts with education. It starts with at home. Parents will try to safeguard their kids, and understandably so, they don't want to expose their children to things that would harm them. But at the same time, they need to be exposed to the world and see how the world operates and how it functions, and then learn how to adapt and deal with it, basically. And that's not being taught anymore.
I think also you have a lot of people that are, and I'm going to take the classic blame the politicians here, but
we've already blamed the public school, so that's the other big one.
Yeah. When you watch the news and you see these politicians from both parties doing all this grandstanding, all it's really doing is misleading people who are maybe in their formative years and deciding kind of what they believe and how they interpret the world. And they've got all these theatrics that politicians are trying to do to score political victories, but do it in a probably misleading way, or at least a disingenuous way. But that affects people who are still kind of learning what they think about the world, and that drives their perceptions, and then that kind of self-propagates.
I personally think part of it may be, more than any other generation, our generation has grown up being raised by external forces that were not our parents. And what I mean by that is, we had not only influences from our public school teachers and other sources, and I think the things that you guys are saying, right, Chris, with the theory about politicians and seeing those in our formative years, and then AJ bringing up the public schools, I think those are both factors and they're great points. I think another culprit could be things like our entertainment. For example, public television. You remember, I'm sure all of us watched Sesame Street and all that PBS programming, and there's a lot of there's a lot of good that came with it. I'm not saying that it's all bad or anything, but at the same time, what were some of the lessons that it tried to teach us? That we're all special, and that if somebody says something, I remember this one very vividly, this came from a lot of different programs, if somebody says something hurtful that essentially it hurts you and they shouldn't be allowed to say, I think that's where a lot of this comes from. We see some of these things coming from children's programming, teaching you that words hurt other people. Well, really, you can take that to an extreme. And if you're doing that at a young age and don't really understand the difference, I think that there's some, I don't want to say brainwashing, but certainly some latent tendencies that lead you to believe that certain speech ought to not be allowed. Because if you equate hurtful speech with actual physical harm, you can see where they would make that connection to where the government ought to step in and intervene.
It's like a precursor to participation trophies.
Maybe that's where a lot of this comes by.
To some degree, everyone is, you know, special, but you're not any more special than someone else, really.
Well, I've always said, I personally like to make the difference, and I know I'm playing with words here, but I've always said everyone is unique. That doesn't make you special.
Yeah.
You can be unique and not be special.
That's true.
All right, guys.
Unique, just like everybody else.
I think it's interesting also, the article continues to go on and talk about the difference between Republicans and conservatives and their view of what role government plays in our rights. For example, I think it said that those who identified as Republicans, a lot of them tended to view freedoms being somewhat second to safety concerns, whereas conservatives were more along the lines of small government, more freedom, not necessarily more security. I think that's interesting, and I think we kind of saw that with this past election, and I think we'll continue to see that in the future as the Republican Party diverges from conservatism.
Yeah, excellent observations. All right, guys, thank you so much for being with us. We'll hopefully be able to talk to you next week. That's Chris, AJ, and Andrew, some of my buddies that I had from college. We appreciate it. We'll be back in just a minute.
Is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Actually, it turns out that the guys are not with us anymore. They had work to do, so.
Unlike us. Well, maybe they're going out and searching for that Brian Williams autobiography.
Maybe so. Or
I want to go to, maybe Books A Million has that.
I don't know. See, that's the thing. Brian Williams was doing fake news before it was a thing. So Brian Williams is a trendsetter.
He was ahead of his time.
That's right.
You know,
if he just waited a little longer, he would have been right in the middle of the fake news craze.
And the poor Titanic will never. I guess, you know, it's just going to be there. Well, it's actually not. Well, it's on the bottom, but the Titanic jokes will be there.
That's right. You know, I don't think it's too soon. It's in the past.
They're all gone. Right.
Yeah, well, they don't care.
I mean, they wouldn't be here anyway.
That's right. That one chick that escaped with the diamond, maybe she's offended, but everybody else is fine. All right, so I did want to talk about this real quick. Last Man Standing has quickly become one of my favorite shows. I discovered it, I don't know, in about its third or fourth season. It had been running for about 3 or 4 years, and one day I saw it on my Netflix feed, and I'm like, what is this? And then I realized it was Tim Allen, and I watched it. Oh, my gosh, it's hysterical.
Yeah, I just started. I was telling you during the break, I just have now started to sort of get into it, as they say, and, well, they take it away.
Yeah. And
kind of like Arrested Development.
Well, Arrested Development had a very dedicated cult following, but it didn't have much in ratings. The difference here is Last Man Standing actually has really good ratings, and so it's really strange that they've decided to cull it off of their lineup. In fact, Dateline noted that it was especially good ratings for Friday night when they were doing their analysis of it. And it was also, this is another reason that the ratings are important, because I realize that a lot of you don't have a broadcasting degree, so I'm going to do this as simply as I can explain it. It was also what they call an anchor show. Now, what an anchor show is it's a show that they put on during the lineup to get you to watch other shows. In other words, they'll put a certain show on first, and then they want that really good show to be on. And that's why you see the really good shows spread out throughout the weeknights instead of having them all on the same night like they did back in the day when you didn't have as many options. And so what they do now is they have an anchor show that they put in the middle of the lineup to try to get you to watch the stuff surrounding it. And that's why you'll see new shows come on after a really popular show. A great example is Big Bang Theory. They'll put their new show on right after Big Bang Theory, hoping that you watch Big Bang Theory and then give the other show a chance because it happens to be on right afterward. Kind of like we are with Rush Limbaugh. Like, that's why I'm on 9 to 11 is because...
We're set up for Limbaugh.
We're just set up for Limbaugh because, you know, what happens is everyone tunes into the Patriot Preacher, and then you might catch some stragglers here and there listening to Rush that they're like, well, Rush is already on, so I guess I'll listen to him now. No, I'm kidding, of course. But... when you think about it like that, the anchor show, that's what they do. Friends was the epitome of this because Friends was such a cultural phenomenon. What they would do is they would put Friends on Thursday nights and then have a less popular show or a newer show air directly after it, hoping that people would watch Friends and then watch whatever was on after it. And so that's what they did with the lineup. That's what they're still doing today. And so it was not only great for ratings, but it also was an anchor show, which meant that it had potential to help other shows, which is another reason why it's baffling that they're cutting it. And on top of that, it was syndication gold. Because now a lot of the shows, used to your big money was in new episodes. Now your big money is actually in syndication because other channels will pay for programming. And what you'll have is TBS or FX or one of these other channels will pay a lot of money to use the episodes to syndicate them. Great example. When Friends was finally opened up to syndication, it was picked up by, I think, Nick at Night and a couple of other networks, and they just made so much money off of it because they opened it up, they sold it for syndication. They have to pay per episode, so however many episodes you're getting determines it. And so now what's happening with a lot of TV shows, is even if the ratings tank, they're still making a couple extra seasons, hoping that what will happen is the people that were fans of the show will still want to watch it in syndication, and even though they're not actually making money on the premiere of the episode, they'll make their money back later by selling it to other channels as part of syndication. And it's interesting that Joe brought that up. Arrested Development's a good example of that. Now they're, because it had such a cult following. Really, Friends is the golden standard for that. Seinfeld does really well with that. NBC's still making money off of that decades after they're gone. So this is a really big deal, the syndication fees. And Last Man Standing had, for a successful show, really everything that you want going for it. It's an anchor show. It's got great ratings for its premiere nights. For the time slot that it was in, I mean, it was still on a Friday night, so it wasn't the best show ever. But it did have really good ratings for when it was on. And on top of that, it also had made a lot of money in syndication because other channels had picked it up, paid a lot of money for it. So it's really baffling that it didn't get renewed for another season.
So you don't have any theory?
No, I do have a theory.
Oh, well, you said it's baffling. So.
Well, but what I'm doing is, before I set up my theory, is essentially saying it doesn't make any sense from a business standpoint why they would get rid of it. The official excuse is that they're having to pay Tim Allen an awful lot of money, which I'm sure that's the case. He's worth a lot. But to my knowledge, he's the only big name actor in that show. And on top of that, there are other shows that they run that have similar formulas that are doing similarly as well, that have those big name actors that they're still paying their salaries for. So from a business standpoint, it really doesn't make any sense. Here's what I think it is. I think it has a lot to do with politics, because Last Man Standing is a very family-driven show. It's a show where the main character is a conservative. He talks about conservative ideas a lot. He has a very traditional view of the world. They had a few seasons ago, they had the big Mitt Romney, President Obama episode where he and his daughters, because the thing is, Tim Allen's character is very conservative, but his daughters are pretty liberal, and he has three daughters. Well, one of his daughters is uber conservative, the youngest, who's his favorite for obvious reasons. But he has, so the thing is, it's not like everybody on the show is a conservative either, that nobody challenges their ideas. His son-in-law is really liberal. His neighbor is a Obama supporter. And so it's not like the only people on the show were conservatives anyway. But it does have a very conservative-leaning slant, or at least a Republican slant, if nothing else. And you have to keep in mind that ABC is owned by Disney, and Disney is run by Bob Iger, which Iger has been a longtime Clinton supporter, been a Clinton guy for a very, very long time. And if you think that Iger is just a businessman who wouldn't make decisions based on his own personal politics, you have to keep in mind, this is the same guy that threw out a $40 million investment in a 9/11 documentary, never re-aired it again, never released it for VHS or home video at all, because it lightly criticized Bill Clinton's involvement with Osama bin Laden, just essentially threw that investment away because he didn't agree with the politics of it. So would not put it past Iger to hand down a mandate to ABC to not renew the show based on that alone. Now, keep in mind, the epitome of this, I think, was surmised in what I thought was a very clever episode. Chuck Larrabee is Mike, Tim Allen's character. That's his neighbor, and he's a former Marine and a Obama supporter, and he's also black. And one of the running jokes in the show is Vanessa, Tim's wife. I don't really know where she stands politically. It's kind of ambiguous, but she gets kind of flustered around black people because she's always super worried about offending them, which is hysterical.
It goes back all in the family, back when Edith Bunker was really sort of apolitical, but she was always sort of
right. And a lot of people have actually drawn parallels. Tim Allen himself has drawn parallels between this show and All in the Family.
Yeah.
And there are some similarities. The son-in-law is uber liberal. He's conservative. And, you do have that back and forth between them going on. And so in this particular episode, his wife is always super worried about offending the Larrabees because they're black. And she brings him over there to discuss the election of Hillary Clinton. This is during the primaries. They're all considering where they're going to vote. And she tries to get this neighbor to convince Eve, her young daughter, who is conservative, to vote for Hillary Clinton because she's a woman. And she's voting for Clinton because she's a woman. And she brings him over there, and there's this really hilarious, but also, I thought, very profound conversation where she's talking to their neighbor. And keep in mind, he's an Obama supporter. She says, wasn't it just really profound for you that Obama won? And he goes, yeah, I voted for him. She says, well, beyond that, and she's trying to say it without saying it. She's trying to say, weren't you proud of it because he was black? And she finally just comes out and says it. He says, no, I'm not proud that a black guy won. I'm proud that a smart guy won, which is a stance I can get on board with. Obviously, yeah. I don't like Obama, but the whole point was, why would you vote for Hillary Clinton? Because she's a woman. Vote for her because you think she's a good candidate. If you like Obama, even though I don't, if you like Obama, vote for him because you think he's the smartest guy. Vote for him because you think he'd be the best president, not because of the color of his skin. And so it was a really profound moment. But in all that, and that's just kind of a snippet of some of the things the show does, I think that that might have been the reason, and some of the things that were brought up like that and how critical they were of Hillary Clinton might have been part of the reason that Iger decided to drop the show. And I don't know if that came down from Iger personally. There's no reporting on that. That's just speculation at this point. We may never know. But we do know that he is the one that owns ABC, and ultimately, if he told someone at NBC to drop the show, they would have to drop it. Now, Tim Allen did something that I think a lot of people would not have expected him to do, which is he created a likable, funny, warm character who's also a strong father figure, loved by his family, loved by his daughters, but he's also a super conservative guy. He has traditional family values. He rants about things. And I think that there were a lot of people that detested that. Now, I loved it. I don't have a problem even with liberal characters as long as they're funny in a sitcom. In fact, that's most characters in a sitcom. But when we were talking about this, there were a lot of people that really detested the fact that he showed conservatives as just being kind of people who love their families. And, you know, they have certain beliefs, of course, like we all do. And I'm not apologizing for them. By any stretch of the imagination. I'm just saying that there are a lot of people that detest the fact that he showed a lighter, warmer side of conservatives, and I think there were a lot of people that didn't like that. In fact, there's a clip by Tim Allen. I think I've got it over there, but I don't know that we have time to play it. Tim Allen went on Jimmy Kimmel about the inauguration, and Kimmel was asking him if he had gone to the inauguration of Donald Trump. So what Kimmel asked him about that, and Tim Allen almost got a little bit defensive. And Kimmel says, well, I'm not bothered by the fact that you went to the inauguration. He's like, okay, well, you know, in this town, you never know. And he said, it's kind of like, and of course he was joking because he's a comedian. That's what he does. But he said, being a conservative in this town is kind of like being a Jew in 1930s Germany.
Ooh.
Now, of course he's kidding. I mean, it was a joke. Everyone was laughing. Kimmel was laughing.
What were we talking about maybe 30 minutes ago? You and I were talking about listeners hearing what they want to hear.
Right, what they want to hear. And there were some people that didn't like that. And I think that there were some people because of the things that he said there, and also because of the way he runs his show and the way it works, that they really didn't like that. And just one last point before we go to a break, because we do have to get out of here, do the Star Spangled Sermon, and get you on to your weekend. Modern Family. It's another sitcom that on the same network that it's a super, super liberal. Two of the characters are gay men that have an adopted daughter. There's one. I mean, the whole cast is just uber, uber liberal. And they also are filmed by 20th Century Fox, so they have essentially exactly the same deal that Last Man Standing did. They're shot by a different company. They're sold to ABC. They have some big-name actors that cost a lot of money. And yet somehow they got renewed, even though their ratings are similar, and Last Man Standing didn't. I'm not saying for sure that I know this is politics. Like I said, this is speculation. This is based on some of the things I've read and heard. But it seems to me that if this had nothing to do with politics, that Modern Family would have got scrapped too. But the super liberal sitcom stays, and the conservative one that is liked by and has great ratings, especially in the middle of the country, that one gets scrapped for some reason. You know, there's a reason Hollywood's not in the middle of the country, is because they really don't understand them and don't relate to them. And I think that this programming decision kind of shows that. All right, we'll be back. Star Spangled Sermon is next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven,
from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. Before we get into the Star Spangled Sermon, I did want to mention that we've got the Black Jacket Symphony returning to the Montgomery Performing Arts Center on September the 16th to present the Beatles' classic album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Tickets are on sale this Friday at 10 a.m. through Ticketmaster outlets. Also, keep in mind that we have that Mother's Day deal that I mentioned earlier in the program, so be sure to check that out, newsradio1440.com. You want to get something nice for mom for Mother's Day, you can win $4,000 just by telling us what makes your mom the greatest. You'll enter just a little blurb about your mom and what she does for you, and hopefully you can win that. Good luck to everybody, but keep in mind, even if you don't win, be sure to save that and then send it to mom on Mother's Day. It'll be a nice little extra present for her, so be sure to do that, newsradio1440.com. All right, now, the Star-Spangled Sermon this morning, I thought about Joshua the other night, and there's this really interesting episode that happens at the tail end of the book of Joshua, where Joshua is essentially almost giving a farewell address to Israel, giving them some rules to live by, as it were. And this is around the period where Israel's trying to settle into the land of Canaan. I mean, they've come in, they've kind of conquered the place, they have the promised land within their grasp, and now what they're trying to do is settle in, get their lives rolling, get on to normalcy. And Joshua is offering this address to this, some parting advice almost. In Joshua 24, 14 through 15, "Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Now, if that sounds familiar, the excerpt of that verse, especially the last part where it says, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord," you'll see that a lot of times on wall art or posters on people's houses. And it's important because I do think that it gives us that reminder that when we're in our own house, especially, we have to set an example. We have to decide what we're going to do. We have to set our mind ahead of time, make a mental commitment to serve God daily. Now, Joshua addresses this. This is really the big question that we all face in life. Because the thing is, even looking forward to the New Testament, there is no halfway with Jesus. You're either with him or you're not. There's no middle ground there. You're either, as he says in the Gospels, a lamb or a goat. You're either clean or you're blemished. There is no halfway status with him. You're either in the kingdom or you're not. And this is kind of the choice that Joshua is setting up. You're either going to serve the gods of your fathers, you're going to serve the gods of the Amorites or beyond the river, or you're going to serve God. You can't do both. See, Israel had this bad habit of trying to do both. They would worship God, but they would also worship some of the idols. He said, no. You want to worship God, you leave those idols behind. They're not important. You cast those away. In reality, this is the choice that we face all the time. Because every single temptation that we face, or every opportunity to help someone to do good, to follow the commands of God, every single one, this is the question we're looking at. Do we serve God, or do we serve ourselves? We're faced with this question on a daily basis. And I love the language that Joshua uses here. He says, choose this day. He's saying, don't put it off. Don't wait around for it. Don't say, I'll think about this tomorrow. He's saying, choose now. It's time. You've got to make this decision right now, or else you're going to look by and your whole life has passed you by, and you never made that decision. And the people that don't make that decision, they wind up lost. And that Joshua doesn't want that for his people. So Joshua is pleading with them. But notice that even though he's essentially begging them to do the right thing, whatever they decide, that doesn't affect his decision. He's saying, I want this for you. I want you to follow God because it's the right thing to do and because it's what's best for you. But even if every single one of you rejects it, me and my family, we're serving the Lord, no matter what you do. See, we can't control what other people do, but we can control what we do. We can control the actions that we take. And Joshua understood that. Even if every person in the world is against us, even if every other person in the world refuses to do what God asks us to do, Joshua says it's our responsibility to do the right thing regardless of what they think. And if that means being an island, then we're supposed to be an island. Because it's not worth your soul. Jesus brought that up in Mark 8:36. He said, what profiteth a man if he gains the whole world and lose his own soul? It's an important question. Because we've only got two options. So we have to decide right now, no hesitation, that it's time for us to do what Joshua did. And for us and our households, we serve the Lord. Something to remember over the weekend. Stay the course, friends.
The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.